Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this program is World Watchers. It's broadcast number 725, November the 4th, 1985. I hope that most of you tape this off the air, that hear it on other radio stations. And many of you know, and some of you don't, that you can write to me, send a self-addressed stamped envelope, that's Mae, and the Brussel is like Brussels sprouts, to P.O. Box 22511, Carmel 93922, and request information how you can get back tapes that are available on the various subjects that I cover, and also you may get bibliography sheets that accompany these broadcasts. If you want to write once a month or send self-addressed stamped envelopes and have me fill them monthly, indicate on the envelope what it's for, because I can't separate all the mail and figure this out. There's too much mail. But if you want the month of October or September, 22-cent stamp holds four sheets that's printed on both sides of information and sources of data where you can obtain these articles or books that I refer to on the air. November is the anniversary, November 22nd, 1963, of the murder of John Kennedy. I've been doing my research for 22 years, and every subject that I choose to describe on these broadcasts for the past 15 years relates back some way to the people who either murdered John Kennedy or covered up the murder. And what I detail many times when I'm not specifically talking about the Kennedy assassination is the way that political assassinations are done and how he was one among many for the same motives and purposes that they're continuing to be done today. So you can send for information about these broadcasts. Also on broadcast number 725, this was just last week, October 28th, I ran down a tremendously large number of names for you that involved the Nazis, the neo-Nazis, drug dealers, gun running, connections to the Vatican, to our own intelligence community and our Justice Department. It was an overview. I didn't expect you to remember all of those names, but I wanted to show you articles that are coming out in the newspapers in the past 2 weeks that link so many disparate units that are apparently not related to connections that I've been sharing with you the past years, and particularly the last year, all being exposed parts of these links through court trials in Palermo, Italy, in New York City, arrests up in Vancouver, an arrest in Phoenix, Arizona, drug dealers from San Diego, and trying to show you how much is in the news now that is literally gushing out that does have a central focus point that I've been talking about for a long time. Now, because I gave so many names and connections last week, it's really too fast to remember all of those various people. Next week, I'm going to go over it again, update what I said with you, and review 725, because it was done as an overview in a hurry, and try to detail it for you. Granted, it could be very confusing to have so many names thrown out, but once in a while, that has to be done, just as you go to a stockbroker and you see across the screens there certain stocks that are up or down or lost or gained or mergers. And if you don't know the companies and the people and you first walk into there or visit Wall Street, it is overwhelming to get so much information. You have to become a student of these things to know that every single one of those numbers is up there for a code, for a reason, and people's fortunes are made or broken on quick decisions, and I believe our lives are made or destroyed by these people who haven't been exposed enough, and there's never enough time to do in detail some of them. So, as I say, that was an overview. Now, this week, I'm just going to talk about Dan White, the role he had in San Francisco murdering, a member of the Board of Supervisors and the mayor, and the politics of San Francisco and the situation of Dan White, the person, as another example of a political zombie that could be used for purposes that did in fact work. William Buckley, who is no stranger to conspiracies, he worked in the Central Intelligence Agency with E. Howard Hunt, and he was in the CIA there. He started National Review, the magazine, in 1955, and the lawyer who did the incorporation papers for him was William Casey, formerly of the OSS, a Knight of Malta from the Vatican, as is Buckley, and now director of the CIA. He set up the corporations for Buckley for his magazine National Review. And in 1970, Buckley came out with a book he first wrote earlier and then updated called The Government Listeth, sounds like you're lisping. L-I-S-T-E-T-H, The Government Listeth, published by Putnam. And I just want to begin the Dan White story by giving you some quotations from William Buckley in this particular book, reprinted from an article he did in Esquire magazine called The Politics of Assassination, and then apply this also to the Dan White story. He wrote in October 68 that Robert Kennedy had a way of saying things loosely and in generalities. Of course, Robert Kennedy was dead in June 68, and Buckley gets the last word. He writes this in October. He said that Robert Kennedy, in April 1968, April 5th, exactly 2 months to the date that he himself would be dead in June, he makes note of that, 2 months exactly, said, "What has violence ever accomplished?" Robert Kennedy asked, and he says, "What has it created?" And he says, "No martyr's cause has ever been stilled by an assassin's bullet." And William Buckley, partner with E. Howard Hunt, Hunt was one of the Watergate defendants with Frank Sturgis, associate of Lee Harvey Oswald in intelligence and the team of Assassination Incorporated, literally, is taking issue with, Buckley is taking issue about this question of Robert Kennedy. Buckley also founded Young Americans for Freedom with Mr. Douglas Caddy, and they brought over 19 people from Munich, Germany, that had a role in the murder of John Kennedy in Dallas, Texas, to divert the newspaper ads written by the Birch Society to make it look like a Jew was involved in the murder of Kennedy. So he takes issue, Buckley, with Robert Kennedy's statement shortly before he died that this never stops a cause. And he brings out the fact that the assassination of George Lincoln Rockwell put an end to the American Nazi Party, which was most clearly a cause. What Buckley doesn't say is that Rockwell worked for him for 2 years, and then when Rockwell was murdered, the American Nazi Party simply changed its name to the National Socialist Party, and William Pierce, who worked for Pratt & Whitney, United Technology, who was the editor of the National Socialist World, took over the role of Rockwell when Rockwell was murdered. And I'll do more about that next week on Rockwell, E. Howard Hunt, and William Buckley. But he goes on and he says the assassination of Imre Nagy and his followers settled that problem. And he doesn't even say who Imre Nagy is. He died in Hungary. He was killed in Hungary, and his brother was part of Permandex organization that worked with Clay Shaw and was in Dallas, Texas at the time John Kennedy was murdered, and played a role with Permandex, and he just passes that off, that a problem was solved by the murder of Nagy. That brought in more fascism into Dallas, Texas, along with the killing of a president of the United States. So now we have the Nazi Party becoming more powerful with William Pierce, bringing in the Defense Department, because Pierce worked for the Air Force, and Pratt Whitney was a physicist with a PhD and a professor. So when the little bunglings get their organizations lopped off, the next group gets more powerful. Then he goes on, the assassination of Malcolm X accompanied the liquidation of the competition to Elijah Muhammad's hegemony. Well, that brought in Louis Farrakhan. So things get tougher and meaner, but the assassination achieves a role, and it always brings these organizations farther to the right than they were when it started. He goes into the assassination of Huey Long, accomplished the termination of a political threat to Franklin Roosevelt, but then there were plans to kill Roosevelt and get him out to make sure that atomic bomb, Harry Truman and General Eisenhower with Richard Nixon under him go farther right. He said the assassination of Trujillo accomplished the reintroduction of democracy to the Dominican Republic, meaning the Gulf and Western took over, the corporations took over, and there hasn't really been a great democracy there. He cites these various assassinations. He says the civil rights assassination in the South, beginning with William Moore, the mailman in 63, and ending with the death of Martin Luther King 5 years later, created an encyclopedia of civil rights legislation. The blacks now have more unemployment, more drugs, less opportunity to get into the mainstream, and the black mayors in Los Angeles, Detroit, and Philadelphia are being discredited with violence, with burnings, with Farrakhan splitting the party there and turning the Jews against the mayor. The assassination of Martin Luther King has brought more fundamentalists of power, with their racism into power, the John Singlaubs and the death squads and so forth, than ever before. And then he said, the whole world is suffering, most of all the United States, from Kennedy's assassination, which introduced a rigidity to Americans' Far Eastern policy. And this is William Buckley covering that up. But the point is, he's trying to say that the assassinations made some change, but actually working on the inner team with the CIA, he knows that each one of these murders brought things tougher to the right, as they did in San Francisco. Even though the gays are more prominent, people like Pat Robertson made $22 million with tax deductions last year, and the religious right and the Jerry Falwell now are ready to slam down on the gays, and they have produced an AIDS, which will eliminate a lot of the problems that the gay movement thought they had in their hands in terms of getting a political vote, even on the Board of Supervisors way back when Harvey Milk was killed. And then finally, he says, the assassination of Robert Kennedy assured the nomination of Hubert Humphrey. Well, so what? As soon as Robert Kennedy was killed, all the upper echelon went to work for Howard Hughes, the right wing, the hidden, I call it the umbrella Gestapo of the United States, with Robert Mayhew and his teams that had hired John Roselli and Sam Giancana, that embarrassed the Kennedys, that played a role in the Kennedy murders. And so Buckley is saying that assassinations, they do not accomplish, many times do not accomplish anything. And then he says, but sometimes they really do. And one has to consider the politics of assassination, Buckley says, because in an age of totalism, assassination is an instrument of policy. It is no less so because some assassinations bring back consequences different from those desired by the assassin. But in this case, everything the assassin wanted in each one of these murders brought around exactly what they wanted, and the politics of assassinations is, in an age of totalism where things are going to be totally controlled, is very important. And then Buckley says, it may be that the politics of assassination will end up doing exactly what it wanted, changing America democracy. That was written after John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King were murdered, and Malcolm X and Medgar Evers, and they will change American democracy, and Dan White is a part of that, and the San Francisco scene. Use them in the past tense, but Dan White still lives, just like Evita Peron lives. Now, there was a article in a newspaper in the San Francisco area, San Francisco Progressive, sent by a friend from World Watchers, and it's an article by Kathleen Baca on the response of people in San Francisco to hearing that Dan White died and commit suicide. And they quoted a person who corresponds and sends me material and gets tapes of the broadcast, Paul Bernardino, of the Committee to Stop the Moral Majority in Fascism that he has in the Bay Area. And he said he wouldn't believe Dan White was dead unless he saw the body. The sheet was over him, and it was taken away. He said, I'll tell you who let White down, he said. It was the corporations. They set him up to kill George Moscone and Harvey Milk, and then they let him out to dry. It's all right here, he said, holding up tape cassettes of Mae Brussel, political researcher and author. The tapes he is selling for $5 profile the life of Harvey Milk and Dan White and include the confession of Dan White, in which he admits to being set up. Now, he's referring to tapes I made several years ago. This was 1978. The years go by so fast. 7 years ago. And I'm very proud of the accuracy of my research. I always am when I look back at the timing and date, because nobody in the United States then or now is addressing themselves to the issues of Dan White in San Francisco, and I was proud that Paul Bernardino brought attention to this. David Emery and Nip Tuck are doing it now with their programs, but Paul took out the early broadcasts and gave credit to the work that I was doing then, as well as what I'm doing now. Now, December 29th, 1978, that was just weeks after the shooting of the two men in the City Hall, I did a broadcast simultaneously on Jonestown and Dan White. And this is what I had about Dan White and the murder of Harvey Milk and George Moscone. I said, first, Dan White is a zombie with no emotions or reactions. That was written 7 years ago. When he was on parole, when he was at Soledad, all the years anyone saw him, the priest or the family parole officer, It was exactly that. He was out of it. No emotions, no reactions in all that time. Two, White was gone 2 years, and he turned into a sleeper killer. He left the police department, in between fire department and police, and went off 2 years and went to Ireland. The stories after he commits suicide this past week or two ago, left out the trips to Ireland. They said he was in Ireland on his honeymoon, but they left out, they said he was in Alaska. But Ireland was a place set up by the IRA and the Vatican, the Knights of Malta, Otto Skorzeny. Skorzeny had approximately 78 castles in Ireland before he died, and he was the head of the whole Odessa network. And there could be many places for mind control. The story, Dan White, is that he adored Ireland and read Irish books and wanted to be in Ireland. But the secret to Dan White is and always was, who did he see in Ireland and where did he stay? When there was a play in San Francisco on the story of Dan White, I tried to get the people involved there to question who he saw and where he was, because he came back then like a zombie, and he was a waiting killer that could kill at any time. In 1978, I said, upon his return to San Francisco, he met, after he came home from Ireland, his future wife, who recently returned from 4 years in Germany and 1 year in Japan. These are broadcast number 369. I asked what cities was White in on that broadcast. And when he got his passport, when did he leave the country? When did he come back? Was Jonestown an assassination zombie training place, as Terry Buford stated when the death took place? And was Dan White sent to Ireland for a couple of years, coming from the same city where Jim Jones' operatives were, working with people from Stanford Research, one of the centers of mind control? How much relationship between Dan White's state of mind going to Ireland and the people from San Francisco being zonked out with drugs and tested for mind control down in Guyana? Now, broadcast 388, May the 11th, 1979, a little further in the year, or actually earlier, it was talking about the defense team for Dan White. They said, you know, on the stand, he was too good for San Francisco. And this was part of his mind control. He was frustrated. Dan White shot and killed the mayor and the supervisor. He had trouble with his working class background and his belief that a man's word is as bond as against the reality of San Francisco politics. On the stand, his defense was, San Francisco is crummy. Those people don't keep their word. They said White's rigid values conflicted with everyday life, his strict Catholic upbringing, his experiences as a soldier in Vietnam, as a policeman, as against the real world. Now, the jury was mostly Catholic, and I went into the structure of the jury. I'll give you some of that in a minute. But the point was, his defense was, he was too good for those cruddy people there. He was better than them. He kept his word. Now, on the jury, this was in May of 79, broadcast 390, I mentioned a Richard Aparicio. He was a member of the San Francisco police officers who was then retired. Mrs. Barbara Costuros, whose husband was the chef at the San Francisco jail and worked in the prison system, in the main jail in San Francisco. Nelson Bermudez, a printer for the Bank of America, and they have tremendous political clout in San Francisco, and people that objected to the conservatives, to the liberal type of activity and the anti-war activity of Harvey Milk. I'll go into that. It wasn't just that he was gay, but he did a lot of other street scene political activities. The foreman of the jury worked for Bechtel Corporation. Casper Weinberger, our Secretary of Defense at the present time, worked with HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, and during the Reagan administration in California, was involved in mind control experiments, and was told to stop it by the late Sam Ervin. I've quoted this before. He came out of Bechtel Corporation, as did George Shultz, but Casper Weinberger was directly linked to mind control experiments and to John Connolly, and other experiments that I have detailed and can do again if you want them. And the jury was Catholic. So you had someone from the police department, from the San Francisco jail, the Bank of America, and Bechtel, and just about all Catholic jury. And they went on, his attorney, White and his attorney, used this defense that he had a strong sense of social responsibility. And after being elected to the Board of Supervisors, he saw the City Hall was rife with corruption, And he felt he was a hero. He didn't have to apologize for anything, and that's just the point. He never said, I'm sorry, because he knows they are bad. They're a different type of people. And what do you say you're sorry for? Martin Bormann never said he was sorry, and Joseph Mengele never said he was sorry, and Dan White never had to say he was sorry. And I quoted the jury, as I say, in May of 79. This is when the trial was going on. White was disillusioned with the manner in which politicians conducted themselves, and he was frustrated. Now, keep in mind that White was a failure in school. He went to college one semester, and they refer to being a veteran. But Dan White went to Vietnam for 1 year. He was a paratrooper. He comes home as a Vietnam paratrooper. There are various stories that he never saw any fighting. I don't know whether he was jumping out to deliver mail or what, but he was there exactly 1 year, and then he was sent to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, for 2 years. Now, that's where you could get mind control, sleepy killers, those sleeper killers. Remember James Frankenberry. I've talked about him before. James Frankenberry is a fellow who sent information that he was meeting with E. Howard Hunt, that's the partner of William Buckley, and that they were training for a shooting into General Walker's window, which would give Walker the chance to tell the people in Germany 2 days after the assassination of the communist Oswald shot him, and they were practicing for the crossfire of a motorcade. So Fort Bragg, where the special forces are, has schools for assassinations. They were training to kill the head of a foreign country and then realized that they were being trained there for domestic assassinations. In fact, Frankenberry had stated, James Frankenberry, that he saw people meeting with E. Howard Hunt. That's the partner of William Buckley, who formed Young Americans for Freedom. And so that the idea that he is better, Dan White is better than all these people, and he's a veteran, does not explain anything about his existences at Fort Bragg for 2 years, not in the battle, so he could be a wiper-outer. Now, remember, from 1968, at least on paper, from 68 to 1974, at the time of Watergate and then the hearings to stop it, the United States government had the COINTEL program to break up the hippies, the gays, the United Prisoners Union, and San Francisco was a city of covert counterintelligence, the rock music, people leaving home, coming to San Francisco. That was Operation Chaos. And in the middle of that comes Dan White, 1 year in Vietnam, and then to Fort Bragg, and then 2 years in Ireland, and meets a woman who's been in Japan, who now works, his wife, Mary Ann, works and did work for the Navy base, United States Army base at Treasure Island. When he killed himself that day, they took her from her teaching job, you know, back to the house to meet what would be her tragedy. And she's at the Navy base, paid by the United States government, and is currently working there. So that this man with strong ideals, this is a script that the attorneys wrote or told him, and this was the brainwashing that you're too good for the city, you're too good for those people. He went to college and couldn't make it. He obviously couldn't handle Vietnam. They pulled him out for another job. He was at the fire department where his father worked. He left that. He was at the police department and took a leave of absence of that. He ran for the Board of Supervisors and stayed a short time and asked to get off of that. He opened a potato restaurant, Baked Potato Pier 39, and then says, well, I don't have enough money. He went to Ireland and picked up 2 years vacation or a short time in Ireland, even if it wasn't 2 years. And then when he gets out of Soledad prison, Dan White goes to Ireland again for a 4 months vacation. Now, the secret to Dan White, before he comes back to San Francisco, what was he doing in Ireland? Here's a family man who had one child who's excused for murdering two people, two politicians in San Francisco, two liberals, was that he couldn't live on the supervisor's salary of $9,000. He had a home. She was working and had degrees, a teaching degree, and one child. So he fathers another child at Soledad Prison, conjugal visits. The child had Down syndrome. And then he has a third child. If he's limited income and he's frustrated, why increase two times over? You're out of prison or you're going to be out. The extra burden of extra children. And then he complained about not these people, not being family people, I guess taking jobs at the gays, not having families. And after he's in prison for 4.5 or 5 years, he takes off for 4 months and leaves a woman who just has a new baby, a baby with a Down syndrome, and a 7-year-old that would need his father anyway. So he's not a family man, and he lived in a separate place. He owned a home in San Francisco, and then he had another apartment, and the brother lived in by that garage where he commits suicide underneath the home. So they had separate housing, and he had the means to go to Ireland 4 months after he's out of prison, not be with his family at all, and come back, and then 2 months later just picks a time to kill himself, and all of this coming down. And he's defending himself at the trial that the city isn't any good, that he's disillusioned with City Hall. Was he disillusioned with City Hall, or was the CIA and Washington, D.C. disillusioned with City Hall? He complained about vote trading that was contrary to his beliefs, and there's no reason to believe he had any beliefs at all. These are things I was talking about in 1979, so we can update them now in 1985 and just see what I was talking about then and how does it share, you know, match up to what we see taking place today. And then the attorney said White lived by the golden rule. And on that broadcast in May of 79, I said the gold that bought the Porsche. He came home from Ireland, got himself a fancy Porsche. And then White, the defense of him of getting that light charge was he came to the defense of weaker children in school when there were fistfights. Well, why gun down people who don't have weapons in their hands, walk into the city hall and do that? And then I did another broadcast on Dan White, updating that, number 390. There's 38390. You can get these back broadcasts and play them. I think, and they connect White to Jonestown, too. And I think it's very important for you in understanding the work that I'm doing now to appreciate that 4 or 5 years from now, you will see these things come together better. But what I'm giving you every week is a view of the past and connecting to the present and telling you where things are leading or the major characters that are making the moves. So I was very happy that Paul Bernardino called attention to the fact that he had tapes that are available to the San Francisco area if they want to understand what the Dan White story is about. Now, November the 1st, 1978, and I had this on the air in May of 79, Representative Leo Ryan sent a wire to Jim Jones, and he said, I'm coming down to Guyana. And November the 1st, 1978, Dan White resigned from the Board of Supervisors. Now, he was a former policeman funded by hidden patrons, and as soon as he got his charge and served his time in Soledad, he went on parole, and there was a $50,000 fund for Dan White. You remember that, just not long ago. And he was living part-time in Bel Air and not the loner they make him out to be. And I referred to his mysterious traveling years, and he was armed with fatal bullets. And so George Moscone is going to be hit shortly after that, 3 or 4 weeks later, by Dan White, who had resigned, and also Leo Ryan, head of the House Intelligence Committee, is going to go to Jonestown. So what you're going to get is Moscone, a liberal Democrat, killed in San Francisco, and Leo Ryan, a thorn in the CIA, trying to stop the CIA funds to Angola, which Ronald Reagan just officially escalated as being able to pour in now. He just was bringing out this week. So, and when Dan White confessed, November 27th, he went to the jail. You see, this was 27 days after he resigned, and just 9 days after Jonestown. He went to the police department, and this was in the San Francisco Chronicle, May the 4th, 1978. He said, some of these people have charged me with taking money from big corporations and not recording it, but I never did that. They were going to use me as a scapegoat. Whether or not I was a good supervisor or not was not the point. This was their political opportunity, and they were going to degrade me and hang me out to dry. And that's what Paul was talking about, that I said he was a zombie under mind control who got rid of Harvey Milk and got rid of Mayor George Moscone and turned the city from the center to the right, brought in the big builders, and he complained then that they were going to hang me out to dry. And I also, that was quite a long broadcast, an entire broadcast, number 390, if you want it, and it has to do with gay smashing and crashing heads and bar stools and broken ribs and carrying on in Castro street where the gays live in San Francisco, a great many of them do, of a lot of violence. There's a trial going on right now about gay bashing on Polk Street. Two people that were murdered just this last year walking down the street because they were gays and had their heads cracked open. And the protection of the San Francisco police and law enforcement who allow these things to go on. The gay bashing was taking place then and it is now. And then June the 1st, 1979, broadcast number 391, I asked the question, who owns Dan White? There was an article in the San Francisco Examiner, and they mentioned some of the corporations who had money inside of Dan White. I'll run those off for you. We'll take a one-minute break and go back to those, and then some more on the mind control of Dan White and how this thing was achieved and how he was told to self-destruct at this time. It was important that he do it right now. I'll take, as I say, 1 minute break and come back to that and share that information with you.